Hello, and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's the week of Friday, November 19th. I'm your host and the editor of Rabble.ca, Chelsea Nash. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble.ca breaks down the news of the day from a progressive lens. It's a good place to catch up and catch on to what's happening in Canadian politics, activism, environment, Indigenous rights, feminism, and so, so much more. You can listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, or you can find all of our content at Rabble.ca. This week on the show, friend of the Rabble family, Libby Davies, interviews climate activist and land defender Rita Wong. Libby Davies is the author of Outside In, a political memoir. She served as the MP for Vancouver East from 1997 through 2015 and is former NDP deputy leader and house leader. She is also the recipient of the Order of Canada. Rita Wong is a poet scholar who has written several books of poetry. She understands natural ecosystems as critical infrastructure that must be protected and cared for in order to survive the climate crisis. In other words, old growth forests are what remains of the Earth's lungs. They discuss Fairy Creek, the site of ongoing protests against old growth logging on the southern portion of Vancouver Island. The protests have been going on for over a year now, with many activists, Rita included, traveling to and from the region when they can, at the invitation of Pahida First Nation Elder Bill Jones and Hereditary Leader Victor Peter, upon whose lands the logging is taking place. Rita has written about her experiences and the plight of the land defenders at Fairy Creek before for Rabble.ca, writing, quote, "The time I've spent at Fairy Creek is some of the most inspiring I've ever experienced, with creative, generous, kind, and talented people, both Indigenous and non-Indigenous, all spontaneously cooperating to uphold what Jones has asked us to, the responsibility to protect sacred forests for future generations." Libby and Rita also take some time to discuss the recent passing of Indigenous writer Lee Miracle, who was a mentor of Rita's. Here they are in conversation.
Well, thank you so much, Rita, for joining me today. Like many, I'm drawn to your unwavering authenticity as a poet, as a change maker, as a teacher. And in a recent article that you wrote for Rabble.ca, you said this about your experience at Fairy Creek, a critical site of engagement for the protection of ancient forests on the West Coast. You said, quote, "Visiting Fairy Creek, I saw both hope for the future as people lovingly and peacefully converged for the sake of the ancient forests, as well as the systemic violence of police officers hiding their names and sporting thin blue line patches." So I'd like to begin there, Rita. The convergence, as you described it, of both hope and change harshly placed within the context of ongoing systemic violence and colonial authority. You've been an amazingly strong ally with Indigenous communities. So how have you been able to navigate those powerful forces of hope when also facing violence through your experiences at Fairy Creek?
Oh, wow. Thank you for that amazing question, Libby. And I just want to say it's a real honor to be in this conversation with you. I'm very grateful for your dedication to communities and to a lot of things that I hold very dear. So I just want to acknowledge that. And, you know, we're both, I think, right now on unceded Coast Salish territories, the traditional homelands of the Musqueam, Squamish, and the Tsleil-Waututh. And before I get to Fairy Creek, I just want to say that a dear mentor of mine, Lee Miracle, I remember her saying that, you know, if you live on Coast Salish territory, you're a Coast Salish citizen and you have Coast Salish responsibilities. Even if you don't understand that and you haven't been taught what your responsibilities are, you have those responsibilities. If we center the land and the place that we live first, right, and then think about how we organize ourselves accordingly. You know, with regards to Fairy Creek, I have to say it has been absolutely amazing what I've witnessed up there, like the incredible people there at the invitation of Pachidat Elder Bill Jones and a number of other people in his community. It has been really hard to see the violence. And I was just actually the other day looking at this footage from, I think it was Monday, Paul Chioctin. He's from the Shanik First Nation. And he was basically telling the RCMP that he was there to protect their kids because they weren't capable of it themselves. And it really hit home for me. Like, when you think about, you know, your your own little, small, humble life in the context of the many, many generations before you and the many generations to come. Like, I think that that long-term view is so important, especially right now, you know, as we see increasing climate destabilization, heat waves, forest fires. You know, I'm in my early 50s and I'm seeing things I never thought I would live to see in my lifetime, and it scares me. And I, you know, if it scares me, I can't imagine what it does to the young people. And that's why so many young people are up there at Fairy Creek, because it's their future, and they're not just their future, but their current lives that are at stake right now. And when I've been up there to witness, and I want to also mention that I only went up there at the invitation of an Indigenous elder, not from Pachidat, but from one of the island nations, Grandma Losa, and that many of us go there with the hope that we can contribute to something, right? That to help protect what's left, what little is left, right? Less than 3% of the ancient forests. And when you're on the ground at Fairy Creek, you learn so much from the people who are there about just being in community with one another. You also, I think, have to think about the systemic kind of challenges at play, the divide and conquer that colonialism has done to us as a whole, and the challenges of trying to heal that. And so, you know, there's a vision of people coming from all four directions, or there's a young woman up there named Rainbow Eyes, who, you know, thinks of us as the Rainbow Nation, of people coming from all directions, because now is the time that we need to do that. And so Fairy Creek really, you know, resonates with a lot of people, because we can see what's at stake and that it's very precious, and that, you know, even when that is clear, there's still clear cutting going on even now. And so tomorrow there's a big court date. And, you know, the question around the injunction, which was initially, you know, not renewed by Judge Thompson and then subsequently reinstated by another judge. I think what's at stake here is the credibility of the colonial courts themselves, what they do to protect us or not in terms of the larger picture. And it seems to me that they're woefully unprepared for climate crisis and not dealing with it seriously enough. And it's those kids on the ground and the elders that are really, I think, in touch with the times we're in. Yeah, I could say a lot about Fairy Creek.
We'll come back to Fairy Creek.
Okay.
But I do want to just pause for a moment and have you say a few words about Lee Miracle, because you mentioned her. And of course, as we know, she tragically died very recently. I know she was a big influence on you. I read an article where you said that you heard her in Calgary in the early 1990s, and she was a big influence. So how has she impacted your life and the perspective that you hold?
Yeah, it was a huge loss, and it was really sudden. You know, for her to pass just on Thursday, Remembrance Day. And when I first met Lee, I'd grown up in Calgary. I was part of what was called the Women of Color Collective. And we understood that we were living in a racist society and that we fight against racism and sexism and classism. But what Lee really did in like a one day workshop, was she helped me to see the larger structure and system of what's at play. So not just about my own experiences as a young racialized woman in Calgary, but also basically what I learned from Lee is that, you know, if you want to fight racism, you have to deal with colonization. You have to deal with the cause and the structure, not just the symptom of that structure. And so that was such a precious lesson, and that she said it with such humor and good grace and just intelligence. Like, Lee's gifts are many, but they include her ability to tell truth and her ability to just be generous and loving. Even when she's being critical, she had just an amazing way of being present and really caring that I learned so much from.
Well, thank you for sharing those few words about her, Rita. I know she's had a huge impact on so many people right across the country, mm-hmm. a whole generation. So her legacy, I know, will live on. You yourself have a long track record of both activism and writing. And I know that you recently published a new book through Wilfrid Laurier University Press, Current and Climate. And it reflects on 20 years of your writing. And it was, I believe, with an introduction by Bradley Nicol. What I was curious about was that in the afterword from you, you address the issue of climate activism and the climate crisis, and you talk about and call people to deal with these issues of systemic injustices with an economy of care and solidarity. So I was wondering, what does that look like to you, an economy of care and solidarity in a concrete way? How do you envision that?
Yeah, absolutely. In a concrete way, let's, for example, apply it to the situation at Ferry Creek. And part of the trouble right now is that the Patchadet Band Council is beholden to Teal Jones for a certain amount of income around logging. And so I think a care economy would restructure it to understand the value of the clean air and the climate stability that that area, that those trees bring, right? And not just the trees, but the whole ecosystem, right? The animals, the birds, the special lichen, like all of it is irreplaceable, basically. And so if we were to build our economies around mutual care, for instance, health, education, environmental literacy, those kinds of things, I think that is closer to what we actually need in terms of the tools going forward. And we spend, I think, unfortunately, too much on subsidizing industries that we can't afford to subsidize anymore. Fossil fuel, for example. Marilyn Waring, the economist, I'm sure you're familiar with her work, but you know, when I think about the work that she did in films like If Women Counted and her many books, you know, just the amount of resources going to the military industrial complex, you know, they totally need to be redirected to care. And it's been interesting to see this movement of people working towards what they call the care economy. So to see health and education and mutual care as a part of the shift that we need, so-called the Green New Deal, is really important, because I think that would be closer to a sustainable economy, and that is clearly needed, right? So low carbon work, work that ensures that there's enough for everybody. And I think in terms of a concrete way forward, we could look at how our public funds are distributed and whether it's not only possible but necessary, I would argue, to increase funding to healthcare, education, and all of those things. The work of people like Rebecca Solnit and David Graeber are also helpful here in thinking about our ideas of debt and how debt, you know, historically is something that can be just reset or restarted. And so we get stuck in these sorts of economic models that are actually really rigid and need a big restart. And, you know, if COVID has taught us anything, it's that if there's political will and understanding, anything's possible. And climate crisis is a bigger crisis, arguably, than COVID. And they're linked, you know, they're not separate from each other. I think the destruction of natural ecosystems has led us to the moment of these sorts of pandemics being more probable. And so it's actually in our long-term interests, I think, to protect the land, not only for ourselves, but, you know, for everybody, future generations.
You've been deeply connected, involved with the struggles, not only concerning Ferry Creek, but also with the Site C Dam on the Peace River here in BC, the TMX pipeline. You've worked as a close ally with the Indigenous community. These issues, in their essence, collide very much with the political world and the world of political decision making, both bad, good, and sometimes indifferent. What have you learned about the nature and success, or not, of political engagement to effect needed changes? And what advice would you give to people who want to understand that process of political engagement? Is it important that we engage politically on these issues?
I think it is, but I also understand how people feel cynical about the political systems that we're in. I certainly experienced that, for example, around the Site C Dam. And, you know, I had volunteered very hard for the NDP thinking that they would stop the dam, and they did not. And that really broke my heart, because the history of that dam, right, that is, was stopped twice before by the BC Utilities Commission in the 80s and the 90s, and that sense of independent assessment that was broken first by the Liberals and then not fixed by the NDP really, you know, makes a lot of people very suspicious of these political systems. That said, I don't see any way around dealing with them. But I also feel like I understand why people are frustrated and fed up and, you know, just upset with them, because they haven't lived by their words. And I think people are still paying enough attention to be aware of greenwashing when it happens. So I forgot to finish my earlier thought around Fairy Creek, and that was the need for what we call independent protected and conserved areas, IPCAs. Mm. That could be a model that centers Indigenous wellness as a way forward, redistributes resources and wealth according to what's needed, as opposed to the current state we're in. And, you know, there are examples of it in Clayoquot Sound, for instance, Haida Gwaii, I think. And there's a lot of really amazing work being done. I think about Dara Kelly's work on Coast Salish economies. I think of that book Indigenomics by Carol Ann Hilton, to really think about the kinds of economies that were here, how they shared wealth. I remember Lee saying once that a law is that everyone eats. You know, nobody goes hungry, nobody goes homeless. Like, that should be where we build our economy from, not this constant emphasis on growth and GDP that is just basically poisoning and killing the planet.
Mm, those are great thoughts, and I think resonate with a lot of people. I mean, you've been involved with these issues for so long, Rita, and I think it's of interest to people to learn or understand what it is that sustains you. You have a lot of energy. You're obviously very committed. So how do you cope with those tough parts where at best it sometimes feels like we're at a standstill, or at worst, we're losing ground? These are tough issues to deal with and to kind of bring it to the present. The world has been very focused on COP22 in Glasgow. And just wondering if you have any reflections on what took place there. And are you optimistic or not? How are you feeling about things these days?
That's interesting. Lee's last book that she wrote with her two daughters is called Hope Matters. And I was just rereading it when I was grieving over Lee. And, you know, I think, I don't know if I have hope, to be honest. It feels pretty bleak some days. But I also feel like whether or not you have hope, it's important to keep doing what you can. I was on a panel once years ago. It was on eco-poetics with Peter Cully. And Peter Cully is a poet in Nanaimo who's passed now. He's like, I don't have any hope whatsoever, right? He says, it doesn't matter. I'm still going to do what needs to be done. And I appreciate that kind of honesty. Like, I want to have hope. And I think that there's also the saying that hope is a verb with its sleeves rolled up, right? Like, it gives you the energy to keep going and to keep doing things. And I would say that part of my ability to continue has been from learning from Indigenous peoples. So here we are on Coast Salish territory. I still go up, and after this talk, I'm actually going up to the watch house, the Coast Salish watch house, which is up at the east gate of the Trans Mountain Tank Farm. And it's been heartbreaking seeing what's going on up there at the tank farm. They have cut down thousands of trees. They're trying to cut down thousands more along the whole path of the pipeline. And that clearly needs to stop, and that whole stupid project needs to become a stranded asset. Like, that is super clear to me. I know that politically it seems impossible, but I also know that there's a more powerful system at play than our arrogant man-made ones, and that is that the natural systems have the final say. Like, natural law basically is non-negotiable. You know, chemistry, biology, physics, like, those are things that we have to come to terms with and adjust ourselves to accordingly, or else we're all out of here. And so there are stories, and they're not my stories to tell, but there are many Indigenous stories of people who have learned from this historically, and that we can learn from it too today. You know, up at the Watch House, one of the key principles or laws, I think of it very often, is this concept of Natsamat. And Natsamat means that we're one heart, one mind, one spirit, that we're all related. And it doesn't just mean humans, right? It also refers to animals, birds, the land, the air, the water. And that interrelatedness is something that is so sacred, right? And so important to hold in our hearts at this moment. So that gives me some energy or will to keep going. Like, the river is non-negotiable. The river's going to keep flowing. You know, do we want to flow with the river, or do we want to kill the river? That's kind of where we're at, you know, in this moment. So if the river's not giving up, I'm not giving up either. You know, that's kind of where I'm at.
Rita, you're an associate professor in critical and cultural studies at Emily Carr University. How does your experience as a land defender inform your teaching, and also your experience as a poet? Are there gaps to bridge between academia and grassroots involvement that students need to understand? How do you apply that in your school life?
That's a great question. I want to maybe backtrack a little bit and acknowledge my dear friend and colleague, Dorothy Christian. Dorothy is also a dear friend of Lee's, and we first met through Lee. Lee organized an event years ago in Bellingham at the University of Washington that brought together Asian and Indigenous women writers. And Dorothy and I struck up a conversation, and then we organized an event at Emily Carr called Downstream. And we were basically responding to a call to take care of the water, this sense that now is the time when people from all four directions need to gather and organize ourselves to protect the water. So in 2012, we organized a gathering which Lee came to and spoke very movingly about that whole area, which, you know, she and her family know for millennia and have experienced in a much deeper level than I, you know, as a newcomer have. But I really appreciated how important it is. And there's an essay in there by Lee, by the way, with the water. And so that is what guides me through all of this, like through all the different struggles that might seem a bit much, but that connection around the water and the land is so important to hold center. And so with what I do at Emily Carr, like I teach an environmental ethics class, it's an elective, and the students who take that class are already looking for work to think about how to honor that relationship with the land. So I'm lucky to be working with artists and, you know, designers and filmmakers who care about those things and are just trying to figure out, you know, where they can best serve. You know, I always like to think of, you know, that to make the work sustainable, it's important to do the things you enjoy doing and also that you're good at doing. Like if you're not a carpenter, don't do that, you know. Do your art, do whatever it is that, you know, nourishes your spirit and hopefully nourishes other people's spirits as well. And I would like to see more land-based pedagogy and, you know, more learning happening outside the walls of the institution, more community partnerships. I think there's a lot of potential that could happen, as well as a lot of obstacles or barriers that maybe can prevent things from happening. But there have been, I think, moments where, for example, when I was in jail in Maple Ridge at the Alouette Correctional Center for Women, because of my principled opposition to the Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion, I found that my colleagues were very supportive and very helpful, you know, that they were like, thank you for your sacrifice. They're like, you know, if you need help covering your classes, you know, we can help you with that. So like informally, I think that people understand we're in a climate crisis and we need to be stepping up our game. You know, no one person has the answer to what to do. But if we work together to coordinate our ideas, I always like to think about what can we achieve together that we can't achieve alone. That I think is helpful to think about when we're just looking at, you know, there's so many things I could do. How do I work at system change, right? And often there's a discussion between so personal changes, I can do this or I can do that. And those are important, but it's really important to keep an eye on the system as well. I went on this retreat many years ago for burnt out activists and based on Joanna Macy's work. And we did an exercise which thinks about three things that need to be coordinated. One is protecting the gains that previous generations have made. So for example, union work, I'm very active in the Faculty Association, which is our union at school, but also having a systemic analysis of how things need to change. And then last but not least, being the change that you want to see, right? So all of those things I think could be coordinated more.
Well, I think that's a very good note to conclude on, Rita, that being the change and working together and upping our game, as you said. So I'd like to thank you so much for speaking with me today and sharing so much insight about the work that you've been doing and what it is we all need to take on.
Oh, thank you, Libby. It's been an honor. There's so much to talk about.
Yeah.
Thanks to Libby Davies for contributing that fantastic interview. And thanks to Rita Wong for coming on the show. Now it's time for In Case You Missed It. Let's stay in BC for just a moment. This week at Rabble, national politics reporter Stephen Wenzel writes about that province's proposal to remove criminal penalties for people who possess small amounts of illicit drugs for personal use. The proposed exemption is a big win for decriminalization activists who have long argued that decriminalization will help reduce the fear and shame associated with substance use that can be a barrier for people seeking care. At the same time, some activists working to combat the opioid crisis say it's not enough. Wenzel spoke to Donald McPherson, executive director for the Canadian Drug Policy Coalition, who said he applauds the BC provincial government for its proposed shift, though he worries that leaving lower jurisdictions to implement varying decriminalization laws will create inconsistent and piecemeal policies around the country. Quote, "This is a federal law. The federal government hasn't taken this leadership," McPherson said. "They should be taking the leadership to decriminalize simple possession for drugs across Canada." Wenzel also spoke to NDP MP and critic for mental health and addictions, Gore Johns, who said ending the stigma around substance use disorders starts with the Prime Minister. In an emailed statement, a spokesperson for Mental Health and Addictions Minister, Carolyn Bennett, who was newly appointed to that role last month, neglected to answer why Canada hasn't issued a public health emergency for toxic drug supply deaths, Wenzel reports. A question asking the minister whether the federal government is considering decriminalization on a countrywide level, and if not, why not, also went unanswered. Quote, "As the opioid and overdose crisis continues to worsen, we must take every measure possible to reduce harms and save lives. We know there is more to do, and our government will remain engaged with partners to move these health-based approaches forward," the statement from the minister's office said. Also on the site this week, it's Trans Awareness Week, with Trans Remembrance Day taking place tomorrow, November 20th. To mark the week, Charlotte Dalwood, a freelance writer based in Alberta, tells the story of how one woman went from being trans ally to being an anti-trans activist and back to an ally again, if not a passive one at this point. Rather than arguing that trans exclusion is anti-feminist, writes Dalwood, trans women and our allies ought to instead mobilize the stories of ex-gender criticals, as the trans exclusionary movement likes to call themselves. Quote, "Whatever such people have done in the past, they are in a unique position now to pull others out of the gender critical movement. That makes them invaluable allies," end quote. Earlier this week, columnist Chuka Ejekam issued a warning to be wary of those who claim to speak for the Black community at large. He tackles the controversial and, as he points out, unfounded opinion piece in the Toronto Star by Royce and James, in which James attempts to take down former Star columnist and writer and activist Desmond Cole. Speaking of the Star, former Star reporter John Miller writes about the major problem facing Canadian media, a loss of public trust. He has some ideas on how we might repair that trust, including constructive journalism and solutions-based journalism that would require journalists to be a little bit more transparent about their process, as well as share solutions to problems and not just point them out. Apparently, the news is a little too negative. You can find all that and much, much more, as always, on rabble.ca. That's it for this week. We'll see you around the site, I hope. If you like the show, please consider subscribing wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can follow us on social media across channels. We're at RabbleCA. And if you have feedback for the show, please get in touch anytime. I'm at editor@rabble.ca. I'm your host, Chelsea Nash. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll talk next week. Thanks to our producer, Brianne Doyle, Libby Davies, and guest, Rita Wong. Thanks to Carl Nirenberg for the music, and all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca.